Brooklyn Party People. We about out of here. It's about 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Crimes and Treasons. Every Thursday, 3 to 5. 101.9 FM. CITR.ca.
And welcome to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. It's Thursday. I'm Ifni. You are not riding your bicycle, probably, because if you are, it's very ill-advised at a time of year when there is all this slippery, goopy, brown, kind of lumpy, oatmeal-y leaf vestiges that will catch you unawares and make you spill your entire body all over the road. So please do be careful taking corners. Also, we're getting frost in the morning. Don't forget, it's Vancouver, but we've had these wonderful sunny days, so it's been a bit chilly, and those morning rides to work are a little bit fraught with surprises. My condolences go out to Ryan, who forewent, is that the past tense of forego? Forewent for too long the maintenance of a frayed toe strap, which unfortunately snapped on a downhill, leading his foot to enter the spokes of his front wheel, and he did an endo. So to all those of you out there who know that there's that thing on your bike that you've been meaning to get to and have not gotten to, I strongly encourage you to attend to it forthwith. Give yourself 48 hours and do it, because you know it will get you. You may not escape as lightly as Ryan did with a few loose teeth. So there we have it. It is Thursday, November 22nd. We're getting into the hind end of 2007. There are a few events coming up I'm just going to briefly mention. And if you are interested in hearing about all this crazy stuff that happens in Vancouver, you should join the Velo Love mailing list. That's Velo Love. Go to velolove.bc.ca and sign yourself up. There is an announcement list and a general list. The announcement list will give you all you need to fill your social calendar if you are bi-wheeled. Midnight Mass is happening tonight, and it is the second anniversary. That's exciting. Midnight Mass is, of course, a bicycle ride that happens. People gather at around 11:45 on the second and fourth Thursday of the month at Grandview Park on Commercial Drive. That's at about Charles. You'll see them. They have red lights blinking. Please do bring your lights, and you may want to wear a helmet and something hot to drink. Hot toddies are a particular favorite of some of the regular riders. But yes, lights are a great idea, as is a helmet, because, of course, there are our police friends are out on the roads in the evening making sure that everyone's riding safe. So it's a fun social ride. Don't feel shy if you don't know anyone. Just go and say hello. It's a fun ride. There is no set destination. They figure it out as they go. And they do ride Critical Mass style. And speaking of Critical Mass, there's the umpteenth anniversary? I don't know. The Critical Mass is coming up again. Of course, it's the last Friday of the month. They're meeting at the Vancouver Art Gallery, as usual, on the side with the two large lions. That would be Friday, November the 30th. They're meeting at between 5:30 and 6 o'clock. At 6 o'clock, there will be an introduction to Critical Mass for people who have never been before about ride protocol. And then the ride will, in its usual gangly fashion, leave the art gallery and ride in a big cluster promoting bike love throughout the city of Vancouver. There are a couple of public forums coming up on the 27th of November, so that would be Tuesday. One of them is a fight, and the other one is a victory. So the fight is a discussion of a Canadian Tire public hearing. It's round three. Ding, ding. So they're people are still plugging away at this. You may recall that Canadian Tire wants to build a humongoid monstrous Canadian Tire at the foot of the Ontario Street Bikeway at Marine Drive, which would, of course, increase car traffic on that route, bringing about 400 cars, I believe, per hour, which is four times the current level. And, of course, that would greatly increase the risk to cyclists using the beloved and loved and intrepid Ontario Bikeway. So there are many people in the bike community wanting to preserve the viability of this bike route and how pleasant and quiet and fun it is. So if you want to get involved and say your piece, there is a number that you can call to register to actually speak out. So far, there have been about 30 people who've spoken out against the big box Canadian Tire development. To register to speak, call 604-873-7269. The meeting again is Tuesday, November the 27th from 7:30 to 10 p.m. at our favorite place, City Hall. That's 12th and Cambie. Go say your piece. The other thing that's happening that very same night, I mentioned it's a victory meeting, and it's part of it's the last chance to review the plans for the China Creek Skateboard Park. You may recall we had on this show some fine young men who were very concerned that the community was being ignored, and there was an overwhelming community involvement actually, and a push to make sure that that park was not just made into kind of a big cement useless block with a little playground on it, that actually retained some of the facilities, very historic skateboard park. And there is, if you want to review the 10th Avenue bike path that crosses through it, the new plans for fixing it up, you may want to go to this meeting and take a look at it and give your okay. So you can go to, let's see, where is it? It's Tuesday, November 27th at 7:30 p.m. at the Mount Pleasant Neighborhood House, 800 East Broadway. Now, there's one thing that's coming up that's a bit far away, but I just want to give you a heads up. It's the Harmonizer fundraiser party for Momentum Magazine. And Momentum, of course, is the magazine for regional cyclists. I believe their website is momentumplanet.ca. If you want to see what kind of stuff they write. But their fundraiser is coming up on December the 15th. So you can buy advance tickets. It's going to be at the Wise Hall, which is Adnack Street, just by Victoria there. And they're going to be performers like Clancy's Angels, Kokoro Dance, DJ and a Beat, The Creaking Planks, which are a favorite of this show, and the Velo Vixens, which are also a favorite of this show. They're an all-woman, all-the-time dance bicycle troupe. So if you want to buy advance tickets, you can get them at Bikes on the Drive. So there you have it. And the ticket sales will start on Friday. That's all I have to say about upcoming events. Again, you've had your safety tip for the day, so digest that. There is no bike traffic report, so you are on your own. Coming up today, very exciting, we're going to have a fabulous speaker who is quite the firebrand. His name is Stephen Rees, and he is a former TransLink staff member who really felt the need strongly to move into the ranks of the rest of us and speak out against some of the activities that have been happening in the province recently to undercut mass transit and sustainable bike routes and things like that. So he's going to be joining us just in a little while, and he has actually requested a song for us to play. It's track number 2, favorite guy of mine, Woody Guthrie. You'll know the song.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling in the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling. Voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and the voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
And you're back on the Pedal Revolutionary Show. This is CITR 101.9 FM. And we just got a call from the police, actually. The pronunciation police, that is. Apparently, and I don't know if it's just my accent or if it's okay in other contexts or if I'm totally wrong, but I will put it out there to the listenership. You are all welcome to weigh in on this by sending an email to pedalrevolutionary@gmail.com. I said route. And apparently route is only used in the military context, and route is what I should have said. I'm not maybe a good Canadian. I'm not sure if there is an American pronunciation. My parents are from Southern Ontario, full disclosure, on this show. So I apologize to the authorities who are listening. But I'm glad to know that somebody's listening. That's always nice. So moving right along, we have a, and I'm going to try, I know the police are listening, so this is really hard. We have a gentleman who describes himself as a recusant transportation economist and regional planner. Did Stephen, how did I do?
You did very well. It's route, by the way. It's definitely route, especially when you're rooting a boot on the route.
Okay.
On the other hand, if it's a military thing, right, when you're getting rid of all the opposition, like we're going to, that's a route.
Right.
So I didn't hear the context in which you spoke.
Well, regardless of the context, it's unforgivable.
No, not at all, because you live so close to the 49th parallel. Americanisms slip over, and they do say Route 66.
It's true.
Some people like that, and people like me go, oh.
Do you say bucket or pail?
I think I say bucket, yes.
Okay, all right. I say bucket, too, so at least I'm not a total loss. And I do assiduously use Canadian spellings. So.
Okay. Recusant is the word that was used by the people who refused to agree with the church and went and hid, right, rather than become Anglo-Catholics. They wanted to stay Roman Catholics. So they went into hiding, and they were called recusant Catholics because they refused to obey the law of the land, and they said, no, we're going to stick to what we know is right.
Mm-hmm.
And although I'm neither of those things, that actually sums up my attitude, which is, look, we know what we're supposed to be doing, and all this mucking about that we're doing at the moment is wrong, and we know that, and we're going to do it anyway, right? So I think people like us have to stand up for what we know to be right.
I was going to say, you don't strike me as the hiding type.
No. Well, I had to for many years, right? When you're a civil servant, you have to keep all this stuff to yourself.
Bottle up.
You discuss it in smoke-filled back rooms, but you don't come out in public and say this stuff.
I have a great image of these smoke-filled back rooms now. Everyone clustered around the water cooler. How? Maybe just give people a brief idea about where you're coming from and how you kind of give us a brief timeline of how you came to be a loose cannon.
Well, I started off actually because I was concerned about the environment. Many years ago now, when I left university, I had done a course in politics, but because I've always been a bit of a train and bus nut, instead of doing all politics, I did something called transport economics, which I found very interesting because I think I really got along well with my teacher, and she was very inspiring. And I went to work for a nationalised industry, which is called British Waterways Board, because we thought that you could do very well by moving things around in barges rather than on trucks. And I spent a few years doing that, and I was recruited from there into the Greater London Council, which is the sort of London equivalent of the GVRD, but much more powerful. And that had been trying to control London's growth and make it more sort of a humane, livable kind of a place. So we didn't use those words in those days. And then Mrs. Thatcher came along, and she decided that she didn't like people making up their own minds about what kind of city they wanted to live in. She had this political philosophy that was based on there is no alternative. In other words, my way or the highway.
Right. That's sounding familiar.
So I was actually, at that time, I had been working on sort of various policy things. So they said to me, would I take charge of the research into regional government? Because they said, we think the government's arguments are wrong. And of course they were. I mean, it was fairly easy to win all the arguments, but you don't win the final battle because she's got a majority in Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So the Greater London Council was abolished. And at that moment, surprise, surprise, along came the British Civil Service, and they said, we're ever so impressed with the work that you did when you were at the GLC. Would you like to come and work for us for a bit? And since I was unemployed at the time, of course, my employer having vanished, I went and worked for the Ministry of Transport to try and clean up some of the mess that they'd made, because they had to admit to us privately that, no, they really didn't know what they were doing, and they needed some of us to come along and show them how London worked. But after 4 or 5 years of that, Mrs. Thatcher used to stamp around the corridors of power and look at people really hard and say, is he one of us? And clearly I wasn't. So I was at that time very jealous of all my friends that I was making, because they were all working for various consulting companies and making far more money than I was. But they also got to do all the interesting work. All I ever did was administer contracts. you know, made sure they did the work properly and all that stuff. But I never got to do the research myself. So I thought it would be nice to work for a consulting company. But because Britain takes this business of conflict of interest very seriously, you couldn't go straight from the civil service into a consulting company the way you can here.
Yeah.
So what they said to me was, yeah, we'll hire you for a consulting company, but we're going to send you some pretty horrible places for 6 months at a time.
And then they sent you to Vancouver. No.
Well, no, not quite. What happened was it looked like it would be more civilized to join a Canadian consulting company and live and work in North America than it would be to tour various third world countries on my own. You know, I wanted to have a family life and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So we relocated to Canada in the end of the 80s. And then, of course, along comes Brian Mulroney, who says, let's have some free trade. And Toronto just simply collapses overnight. I mean, manufacturing just disappears. All the jobs go. The economy collapses. The house that we've just bought turns out to be completely worthless. So there we are, you know, totally stranded in Canada with a young family and no work. So that's how I came to British Columbia.
Right. And so how long have you lived in Vancouver?
We came to Victoria, actually.
Okay.
This was the middle of the 90s in the Glenn Clark era. I came, having been an international consultant for a bit, I got tired of being shot at and stuff. So I took a job with the Ministry of Energy in Victoria in the middle of the Glenn Clark era. And that lasted for all of 2 years and something like 11 months.
Okay.
If I'd been there for 3 years, I would have been a civil servant to this day. But Glenn Clark decided he was going to downsize his civil service. And it's last in, first out, right? So nobody wanted a job in Vancouver. They were all very happy in Victoria.
Why not?
So, I don't know. It's very strange. But they would follow me around, you see. And other ministries would offer me jobs.
Uh-huh.
And then the people who had been in longer than me had bumping rights. So I was getting them jobs rather than getting me a job. So in the end, I went to BC Transit in Vancouver because nobody else wanted that.
Right.
And I was with Transit for 7 years.
Okay. And then now let's just jump to the present.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about Kill Bill.
Kill Bill 43.
Yeah. And we want to actually just try to play a little bit of a trailer. So if I can get you to hang on 1 second.
Certainly.
Right on.
In a world where one man can define the fate of a province, where money and power control everything. A world where politicians make science.
There's virtually no impact on greenhouse gases on the $3 billion gateway program.
Transportation Minister Kevin Falcon will act alone to decide your future with a gateway to hell. Freeways, smog, greenhouse gases, loss of farmland, traffic jams, environmental destruction, global Armageddon. But there is hope.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know.
A resistance movement is born.
Every rule and law that we have and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms was put there by somebody's peaceful civil disobedience. It may come to that again, so think about it.
But who will win? Join the resistance. Save TransLink. Fight Gateway. Defend democracy. On November 21st, join us to kill Bill 43. The bill to privatize your transit system. Visit keeptranslinkpublic.ca or gatewaysucks.org for more details.
So good. So good. So what do you want to say about Bill 43?
Well, Bill 43 was dreamed up by Kevin Falcon when he had a bad day. he wanted to move ahead with the Canada line, and the board of TransLink really wasn't sure that they wanted to go along with that. And that's because the region had its own plan for rapid transit, and the first thing that really ought to have been done was finish off the job. I mean, when they built the Millennium Line, it's actually two bits of two other lines. and it doesn't actually go anywhere. It just doubles it back on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the planners at TransLink had been saying for some time the line out to Coquitlam was the number one priority. That's the one that's now called the Evergreen Line. And a line to Richmond really wasn't on anybody's agenda.
Why was Coquitlam? Okay, so why was Coquitlam a higher priority then?
Well, because Coquitlam had been promised rapid transit a long time ago, and so had Port Moody,
right.
And they had got on and they had done the densification that goes with that. They had done transit-oriented development without any rapid transit.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Port Moody, for example, you know, it has lots of high-rises. It has lots of walkability. It's a very nice little waterside community.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem, of course, is that although they've got West Coast Express,
mm-hmm.
which connects them to downtown Vancouver, the connections to the rest of the region are really quite awkward
mm-hmm.
Because of the geography.
Right.
But everybody had expected that there was going to be a SkyTrain. When the plans went through 20, 30 years ago, you know, Coquitlam had set aside allowances in the development, you know, which would have allowed the train to go through. And people like Mayor Trasolini in Port Moody they really got very fed up because they had allowed developers to go ahead and do things
mm-hmm.
which would have fitted if they had rapid transit, but don't work at all well if everybody drives.
Right.
So there was a necessity to actually deliver. I mean, if you're going to make a plan, you have to stick to it. There's no point in having plans if you're then mm-hmm. going to make it up as you go along.
Unless there's some kind of egregious reason to change, yeah, absolutely.
Well, unless circumstances change, mm-hmm. unless there's some, you know, huge thing that you forgot about when you made your plan, unless your assumptions turn out to be completely wrong.
Right, so in Kevin Falcon's mind then, there was obviously some egregious change that happened.
No. There has been, for a long time, a simple political thing, you know, that the Liberals and the Conservatives, you know, the people on the right wanted to see some kind of Richmond Rapid Transit system, and the people on the left thought, no, east-west movement was more important than north-south movement.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is to do with the fact that Richmond was never supposed to be this major urban area because it was in an area which is subject to flooding and liable to, you know, be disrupted by an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got saturated silt as
yeah.
the thing that you're building on, you really don't want to shake that too hard because things tend to fall down.
Mm-hmm. And sink.
Yeah, so the thing was, you know, that, and anyway, who the heck wants to live underneath the flight path of an airport? You know, that's where the airport is. And if you move into, you know, anywhere sort of immediately next to that, you're
right.
going to be subject to aircraft noise.
So then what's this Bill 43 then?
Okay, Bill 43 was because Kevin Falcon got very upset when the TransLink board says, we want to do Evergreen Line first. And in the end, he came up with a compromise and said, well, how about we do them both at the same time? And so the TransLink board said, well, all right, then we can live with that. And then, of course, he didn't do the Evergreen Line at all. He broke his promise, but that's what you expect, wouldn't you? He's a politician. Kevin Falcon was very offended by the fact that local mayors and councillors actually took seriously the job which the legislature delegated to them. There is a GVTA Act that set up TransLink and which was a part of a program to devolve the management of transportation in this region to local government, and saying it is a local regional concern, it is not a provincial concern. But Kevin Falcon doesn't see things that way. He sees it much more in terms of my way and everybody else is wrong. You know, he doesn't recognize that there might be different legitimate differences of opinion based on what your perspectives are.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at things from a regional perspective, you tend to see them differently from what you see when you look at them from a provincial perspective.
Right. And I saw a quote from MLA for Esquimalt Michosin, Maureen Karaganis, and she called Bill 43 the most insidious, quote, the most insidious piece of legislation since the BC Liberals came back to a full majority in 2005. So what's going on here for people so that they can kind of...
Basically, what Kevin Falcon wants to do is get rid of the way that TransLink is currently operated, which is that mayors and councillors from cities around the region, there's mm-hmm. 21 municipalities, but the board is only about 10 or 12 people, I can't remember exactly,
mm-hmm.
But what happens is that those elected representatives currently sit on the board and make the decisions. Now, they're not elected to that position. They get it because, as a mayor or a councillor, they're already representing their municipality at the GVRD board.
They've already been elected,
essentially. Yeah, so it's one of those sort of at one stage removed. And that's always been a bit of an issue in terms of accountability and so on. But tell that to George Puhl, right? He was the chair of the GVTA. He got really hammered over the bus strike, and he just about finished his career. So there's certainly evidence that although it may be at one step removed, it still works.
And it's how we. I mean, ministers are on a federal level are appointed as well, but they're already elected. So
yeah, I mean it's. But the thing is, this board, right? When you have public bodies, you can have them as various kinds. There are various kinds of ways of doing it. You'd have a Crown Corporation, which is what BC Transit was, or you could have something like BC Hydro and so on, right? There are different ways of organising yourself. But what seems to be popular at the moment, and what the principle that they've established with the port and the airport, is that instead of having elected officials on board, you just simply go to some of the interest groups, like the Board of Trade, or in some cases the Association of Accountants, or whatever they call themselves, and you appoint people. And what that tends to be is a very sneaky way of making sure that your friends get on the board and nobody else does. Because when you appoint mayors and councillors, what you're doing is you're importing politics, and you're importing local politics at that. So the TransLink board has been a place where things do get debated. You know, that the mayor of Vancouver and the mayor of Burnaby tend to have different views on things. They're elected by different people and they have different perspectives. So, yeah, you get a lot of discussion and debate, and it all happens in public. But the board meetings are always open.
Yeah.
And they move them around the region so that people can go to it and attend it. Now, that makes people like Kevin Falcon very uncomfortable. He would much rather do deals out of sight and come out with them afterwards and just tell people, we're going to do this. He's on record as saying he doesn't like public consultation, doesn't like having to consult people and tell them what he's doing and ask them to approve their plans before he starts. He just likes it. He likes the Chinese method, right? He was actually on record.
The Chinese government method.
Yeah, he was saying, look at the way the Chinese do things. If they want to build a highway or a freeway, they just go ahead and
just do it. I remember that. And it's funny, just so people know, too, this stuff is being pushed through very, very quickly. Like, we're talking about the end of this month, and we're also talking about, TransLink being renamed the South Coast BC Transportation Authority as of January the 1st of 2008. This is not something that there's going to be a big review process, and we're going to talk about the pros and cons of this. It seems like he's just going to do it. And the ironic thing is, in his mind, I read a quote from him that said, it's going to restore public confidence and accountability in TransLink, which is ironic. I mean, did he forget to put the word games, like confidence games, or was it a slip of the tongue, or is he hallucinating?
I've read, no, I mean, what Maureen Corrie-Jonas was saying yesterday, and which I wasn't aware of, was that they haven't actually discussed this in the House.
That's right.
We expect normally when you put legislation forward that there's at least some kind of debate.
In a democracy, anyway.
And there's only 5 days left in the session, and the Liberals keep bringing other legislation in instead of this bill. And this bill has already fallen off the table once before. It was supposed to be passed in the last session, and they didn't get around to it. So there are two possible scenarios. One is that towards the end of the session, they'll just go for a procedure called closure when there's no debate, you just vote on it. Or the other one is you forget about it and you bring it back next time. Now, I think they'll probably go for the first rather than the second.
If they go for closure, what do you foresee happening?
Well, they've got a majority, right?
Okay.
So they just simply bring a motion before the House, and the House, because the House is split the way it is between the NDP and the Liberals, the Liberals have got more seats than the NDP does, they will get their way, won't they?
I should mention to folks listening, if you do have any questions, give us a call in the studio. It's 604-UBCCITR. Yeah, this is also, Stephen, I want to mention that you do a blog where people can read more in-depth about this stuff, and it's Stephen Rees, that's with a P-H in the Stephen, R-E-E-S, yes?
That's it.
And that's at stephenrees.wordpress.com. You can also see the film version of that audio PSA that we played of the frightening Kill Bill.
And somebody also had a camera phone with them last night, so I've put up a little video of me talking.
Excellent.
if you haven't had enough of me talking this afternoon, you can get even more of it later on.
And you can get a visual. Also, there are a couple of other websites to mention, too, and, of course, gatewaysucks.org being one. Also, an organization called keeptranslinkpublic.ca is a good one. You said something interesting to me. You said follow the money, which I thought was interesting when we're wondering about what the motivation is oftentimes. Yeah. I mean, if we look in two different directions from, you know, downtown Vancouver, if we look to the east and we look to the south, we see Gateway and we see Delta, and it seems like there's this really interesting transportation synergy that's happening and sustainability synergy that's happening, or anti-sustainability synergy, with projects like Gateway and with projects like, you know, the proposed LNG, liquid natural gas, infrastructure being put in out in Tsawwassen. So do you want to kind of talk a little bit about how things interweave with each other?
Let's look first of all at the context, right, which is that this region has been growing very rapidly and is projected to continue growing very rapidly. There's another 1 million people coming in the next 20 years, and they're going to want somewhere to live. And there is a lot of money to be made if you can turn land which is currently not used for housing into housing. Now, one of the things the Livable Region Strategy says is we're going to build a compact urban region with complete communities, and we're going to protect the green zone. And we're going to do that by increasing transportation choice. Right? Those 14 words summarize Livable Region. And there are people who think that if they can get around that somehow by reducing transportation choice, they will therefore be able to start encroaching on the green zone and turning that into, you know, places that they can sell to people. Because when you change land from parkland or Burns Bog, agricultural land, if you turn that into development land, just simply by that stroke of the pen, by changing that land use designation, you've increased its value tenfold. Mm-hmm. When a piece of land in Richmond came up for discussion, that was a former piece of Department of Defense land that was used for radio masts, at Number 4 and Garden City. I mean, the value absolutely rocketed as soon as they said, we're going to take it out of the ALR, the Agricultural Land Reserve. It had never been used for agriculture, but because of the nature of Richmond, it had always been assumed that land not used for anything else would be agricultural. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, because you now said, well, no, we're going to put lots of houses on it, it becomes incredibly valuable. Mm-hmm. So this kind of gain that you get from just simply planning designations or changing land use zonings is a favorite way for developers to make huge amounts of money.
Right.
And there's also a lot of money to be made, by the way, in the case of Delta that you mentioned. You know, when you're changing land for ports or if you're building new highways, you know, that's going to take up a lot of land. So if you're lucky enough to own that land and your piece of land is critical to that development, then you stand to make a great deal of money because they need to buy you out and they have to pay you fair market value. Mm-hmm. So fair market value, of course, goes up very quickly because we need that and you have to give it to us kind of stuff.
Yeah. So, I want to just take a couple-minute break and we'll play another song. This is dedicated to you, Stephen. It's called The Man Who Said No.
That I love so, and he said, you find another man to be part of your nightmare.
Hey, hey, hey.
You find another fool to give you love and care.
Hey, hey.
'Cause I can do bad by myself, not gonna take care of you or anybody else. He was the man that said no. He was the man that I love so, and he said, I ain't going for all that talk about love. By heaven above,
hey, hey.
I want to live alone in this world, and what I really don't need is one of those glamour girls. He was the man that said no. He was the man, oh, I love him so.
Hey, 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 hey.
And welcome back to the Pedal Revolutionary Show, CITR 101.9 FM. You can visit the Pedal Rev blog by going to pedalrev, P-E-D-A-L-R-E-V .blogspot.com. And that will take you to our archives if you're interested in hearing more of our ridiculousness spread before you. We're talking today to Stephen Rees, who is a local dissenter and nonconformist who's come a long way to kind of arrive at this point in history in the city of Vancouver as we try to resist some of the changes that are our city is being fraught with at the moment, it seems. You mentioned the Livable Region. Is it the Livable Region Coalition?
That's the group that I currently work with on a volunteer basis. It's a group of environmentalists who are very concerned about what would happen to this region if we see the twinning of the Portman Bridge and the twinning of the highway. Well, in fact, the whole Gateway program, but that mm-hmm. particular component of it is the thing that's brought us together. We've also made alliances with other anti-Gateway groups who are more concerned about things like port expansion or the South Fraser Perimeter Road or the other elements.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very ill-thought-out plan, and it's been foisted on us by people who are being very self-interested, mm-hmm. but certainly not looking at what's good for us in general, or what's good for the region, but what's good for them personally.
Right. And so what are you guys doing? What are your undertakings at the moment? And
what we've been concentrating on up to now is we've been trying to work within the system. Two of the items, the South Fraser Perimeter Road and the twinning of the freeway, are both the subject of what's called an environmental assessment. Major projects in British Columbia and indeed in Canada are both subject to environmental assessment legislation, and they have to satisfy the Environmental Assessment Office.
That must keep Kevin Falcon awake at night.
Well, the real problem, you see, is that they have come up with vast amounts of... it's the usual thing. What you do is you turn on the printer and just press a few buttons on your computer, and you can produce volumes of information. And what we've had to do is plough through that steadily, and what we've discovered is most of it is a load of old dingo's kidneys. It's stuff that they've either made ridiculous assumptions or they just simply ignored the science and pressed on anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to Pamela Zevitt, who looked at the biological stuff for us. She's a registered biologist, and she does environmental assessment work for all kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And she said it was etch-a-sketch planning, which was a new one on me.
Can we shake it? We've got to shake it, right?
She just turn it over, shake it, and pretend you've got a blank screen and start again.
Wow.
Because what they had done is they had looked at these bits of land and said, you know what, we're going to use those to mitigate all these terrible environmental effects that this highway is going to have. And what she noticed was that every piece of land that they picked was already being used for mitigation for the last time they expanded the freeway.
Wow.
And so she was saying, I don't think that's allowed. That's not playing fair, is it?
It's a good thing that we're not as stupid as they think we are.
Well, the other one is the greenhouse gas argument. You see, that's been the real big one. Eric Doherty, who is a student at UBC, he's actually doing a transportation degree at UBC at the moment, and he's been looking at this stuff and managing to turn some of the environmental assessment stuff into his term papers. Mm. And one of the things he's been looking at is the greenhouse gas emissions, because the figures that they've presented just don't add up. I mean, it just doesn't seem credible to anybody that you can double the size of the freeway, build the South Fraser Perimeter Road, expand the port, and then say, oh, but that's not going to have any impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes sense.
Yeah.
So what we did, we went and had a look at that, and he came and talked to me about it, and we sat down, and I had a look at how they had done the demand forecast, because they used this thing called the regional transportation model that I used to work with. And the problem with that thing is it doesn't have any land use in it, or rather, its land use is put into it on the basis of what we happen to have at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The model itself just simply accepts whatever land use you give it. It doesn't have any ability to do a feedback that says, if you build a transportation network differently, have impacts on the accessibility surface. I mean, there's none of that complexity in the model.
Mm-hmm.
It just simply looks at a network given a set of assumptions about land use. And what all that they had done is run this model right the way through to 2031, and they said that the land use will be the same no matter what happens. And that was an assumption. That wasn't what the model told you. So surprise, surprise, what the model tells you is if the land use is the same, then the number of trips is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one thing that we know is that when you expand freeways, you increase the number of trips.
Yes.
And that happens even if the population stays exactly the same.
Yes.
The reason it happens is people can make more trips, so they do.
Yeah, there's
right now, the congestion itself acts as a restraint on trip-making. People look at it and say, oh, God, it's not worth doing it. If I'm going to sit there in traffic for 20 minutes, I'm not going to go for that trip. I'll combine the trip with another purpose, or I'll call up Amazon.com or something, rather than going to the bookshop. You know, it's that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you take that congestion away, you don't have that constraint, and therefore people will make more and more trips. And every time we've looked at this in every city that's got a motorized population, that's exactly what happens. In fact, the Texas Transportation Institute, God bless them, every year do a report on traffic in North America. And they look at 95 cities, city regions, and they say, let's compare the ones that have been trying to build their way out of congestion with those that have been trying to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And what they discovered is there isn't a single city region that's actually managed to cure congestion by building roads.
If you build it, they will come.
But what happens is that if you build roads as quickly as the car population is growing, the number of vehicles, if you try and keep up with that figure,
mm-hmm.
what happens is you spend an enormous amount of money and congestion gets bad at a slightly slower rate than it would have done otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all, right? You can't keep up with congestion. It continues to get worse, just not as quickly as it would have done if you hadn't increased the size of the network.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a self-defeating policy. And therefore, in every city around the world that has been looking at this, people are saying, it's pointless continuing to build freeways. Let's see if we can get another way of doing it. So that's why nearly every city you go to is busy building railways.
Mm-hmm.
There's light rail, there's subways, there's monorails, there's all kinds of stuff happening all over the world. In fact, I thought one of the really interesting things was he's going back to Kevin's favourite place, China. They had decided that they were going to have an automobile-oriented society because that would enable them to grow quickly, they thought, economically. And after 5 years, they've just given up on that. You know, Beijing, the air quality is so appalling and the traffic has got so bad. But they've now decided that they're going to build many more metro systems.
Mm-hmm.
Shanghai is going to have the world's biggest metro system within the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And
because
I know
they couldn't keep up with the traffic.
Yeah. You've mentioned some things as well about air quality. We were just talking about a little bit ago. And alternative fuels, which are not only controversial, but there's some really kind of unpleasant news coming out about these things.
Well, one of the things that's going to happen is when the freeway is expanded, you're going to see more vehicles. And more vehicles means more emissions of all kinds. And although we've found that vehicles have been getting cleaner on the whole, we have been fairly successful with programs like Air Care, but also with regulations on tailpipe emissions.
Mm-hmm.
They have been managing to keep that the growth of the air pollution down a bit. If you see the traffic expanding, then you start losing that battle again.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that happens is that as vehicles get bigger, the more energy they consume. And one of the things that happens because, you know, yes, engines have got more efficient, hybrids are coming in. But if you put a hybrid in a Tahoe, it's still a very large vehicle indeed. And if the guy who now drives a Tahoe used to drive a Chevette, all of a sudden, you know, you've got 10 times more emissions going out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been happening. The vehicles have been getting bigger, and all the benefits that we've had from technology have been wasted.
Mm-hmm.
There has been some recent research, again by students at UBC, who have been tracking children in the Fraser Valley. And what they're discovering is it's not just the things that you'd expect to see from air pollution. You know, there's traditional things like childhood asthma attacks,
mm-hmm.
which are very closely related to how close they live to the freeway, how much traffic's in the area. And you can actually draw a map, and you get a plot which shows
wow.
you the closer you are to the road, the worse your child's health going to be. But they've also discovered that there's a similar kind of correlation with things like middle ear infections in very small children. which can be very serious and certainly will give parents plenty of sleepless nights. So, you know, the whole health question that comes out of this is, have you looked at this, Mr. Falcon? Well, if you're predicting there's not going to be any change in the traffic, that doesn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
But the prediction that says there isn't going to be a change in traffic just simply isn't credible. So what we've been saying about the environmental assessment all the way through is, if you had done the work properly with the demand forecast, if you had taken into account the effect it will have, first, inducing more travel, and secondly, changing the way that land use is going to develop, because we know that there is an association in people's minds between land value and accessibility. How quickly you can get around is what determines the value of your property, frankly. Yeah, if you live in the back of the boonies, it's really cheap. You live in the centre of town where you can get everywhere really quickly, it's very expensive. So we know that as the freeway is expanded, so the developers move in. And in fact, they're already doing it. You can already see people who have decided that it's a done deal, that Langley is going to see yet more of the kind of sprawling subdivisions that they've been putting up there for the last 20 years, and they're going to do more of it.
So what can folks, again, I mean, you guys sound like you are really taking the bull by the horns and getting in the the fray and really working out the crappy logic that has been forced on all of us. But how can people either support that effort, or how can they really plant their feet and stand against all this crap that's going on?
Well, a lot of it is to make sure that your elected representatives know how you feel. If this is a matter of concern to you, don't keep it to yourself. Tell someone.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about it with your neighbours, of course, and your friends and so on. But also get in touch with your MLA. Get in touch with your councillors. Ask them if they think this is a really good idea and what they propose to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Ask them if they feel that the environmental assessment was actually done fairly and properly. As I said, up to now, we've gone along with the process and we've tried to work within the system.
Mm-hmm.
But we get the impression that they're not listening. I mean, one of the things that really worries me right now is that Gordon Campbell has got up on his hind legs and has committed himself to reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you, Gordon. That seems to be very sensible.
Mm-hmm.
He said we're going to have a 30% reduction by 2020, and I think that's wonderful. I wrote him a letter, and I said, excuse me, how do you propose to do that and increase the amount of traffic into the Fraser Valley at the same time? Because we know that your greenhouse gas calculations that you submitted to the EA were wrong. How do you propose to change that? And all he said to me was, well, we've forwarded that to Kevin Velgan. And you get the impression that he didn't actually read the letter, let alone write the reply. You know, there's probably some autoresponder that churns this stuff out.
Stephen, you probably have the best vocabulary that I've run across in a long time. What's a stronger word than flagrant?
I'm not sure there is. I mean, it seems to me to be extraordinary that they think they can get away with this stuff.
Mm. What I think maybe it's almost like a microcosm of what's happening, too, is the whole turnstile issue as far as the SkyTrain goes. And, you know,
it's really bizarre. I can't understand. I used to have at work, when I worked at TransLink, I used to have a little spreadsheet on my computer because this was one of those questions that kept coming up. You know, people would keep saying, if we had turnstiles, wouldn't it save a lot of money?
Mm-hmm.
And what we tried to do with them is sit them down and say, okay, how much do you think it's going to be? How much do you think we're losing? You know, because anybody's guess, right? We didn't claim that we had, you know, the virtue of all knowledge.
Right.
But what we could do is we could say, look, this is how much we collect in fares right now. This is the number of people that we think are traveling based on our counts. Now, what kind of percentage do you think it's going to be? We said it was 6 to 8%. Other people came up with higher figures. I would put the figures through the spreadsheet, and I'd say, okay, let's suppose it's 20%. Let's suppose that the fares go up by this much, therefore we're losing this much money in future. Now let's look at the cost of buying the gates and installing them in the stations. Oh, and by the way, on the Expo line, you have to rebuild every single station.
Oh.
The reason for that is that you have to be able to evacuate it in the event of an emergency.
Right.
That's not anything that TransLink has any control over. That's what the fire marshal says. And it's not fires, of course. It's things like bomb alerts or somebody letting off, you know, sarin gas or something like that. You know, you have to be able to clear the place really, really quickly. And if you've got gates in the way, they're not going to be able to get out. So you have to build emergency exits. And what that means in the case of the old Expo Line stations, especially the ones that are underground in downtown, by the way, Mm-hmm. You think about Granville Station, right? One of those great big long escalators.
Yeah.
That's going to cost a heck of a lot of money to do. So we have a figure. We know how much that would cost. I don't know what the latest figure is because I haven't been there for 4 years, but it was a lot of money. And what it meant was that when you look at how much you would have to spend. Oh, the other thing you have to do with gates.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, but just to make
no.
it a little bit more interesting.
This is interesting.
When somebody comes along to the gate and they've got a big bag with them, like, you know, one of those roll-along suitcases like they take to the airport, or they've got a kid in a stroller, or they're using a wheelchair or a scooter, well, it's not going to fit through the gate.
Yeah.
So you have to have somebody there to open up a gate for them.
That's exactly how they do it in Tokyo. They have a guy who can override the system and let
them
through.
Okay, well, that means... Now, the system is open from, what, 5 in the morning till 12 at night?
Yeah.
So that's three shifts, plus they need meal breaks, plus they need to go to the toilet. So you can't have them, just one person there.
Right.
You need about half a dozen people to man this gate in case somebody comes along.
And see, I think what the weirdest part of this whole thing is that Malcolm Brody, the Translink chair, and Kevin Falcon both seem to be of the opinion that they have a feeling it will increase revenue, even though that's not what Translink said in 2005 when they studied this whole thing and again rejected the idea of getting in these turnstiles. So personally, I kind of think off the top of my head, you know, the cost of remedial arithmetic for the Minister of Transportation and maybe the whole Translink board, if that was done 8 hours a day, 6 days a week for maybe the next 2,000 years, it would still be far lower than any plan Kevin Falcon's ever proposed.
But the problem is that once you start having... I mean, the whole point about SkyTrain is it's unmanned, right? It's an automatic system. But the problem is that because people keep saying, I don't feel safe on an unmanned system, you have more and more people devoted to jobs like security. I don't know of any other transit system in the world that uses armed police to go and check tickets. And by the way, those armed policemen are on record as saying, we go through SkyTrain and we don't find people riding without tickets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and train after train gets checked and there's nobody on there who doesn't have a ticket.
Well, and the thing is, one reason for this misperception might be that you see all these people going on the train without buying tickets all the time, but of course they have transfers or they have a pass or they have all these things,
so
it's inflated.
They paid on the bus or they paid at the office. You know, they're carrying a pass.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why the system works. I mean, systems which require everyone to stop and be checked, you know, you can't move that number of people through the building. You can't load the trains faster.
So what do we do about this ridiculousness? Do we just kind of, we go out and we do, you know, we can do rallies and we can
One of the
complain.
Things that will happen is that he will get this professional board and it will include some accountants and they're people who can do sums. I mean, even if Kevin can't do them, they can do them. And they're going to look at this thing and say, Kevin, are you sure you want us to do this? Are you really, really sure? Because this is the way the figures work out.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll use the updated construction costs, which will be much higher than the last time I looked, because construction costs have gone through the ceiling as a result of this, you know, rush for construction ahead of 2010 that's been going on.
Right.
Everything costs far more than it used to because there's this dreadful shortage of tilers and concrete setters and so on. You know. You just simply can't get the labour.
Right.
So you say to them, well, you know, I think what will happen is that the accountants are going to tell Kevin that he's barking. You know, that he can't.
Is that like barking mad? Is that?
Yes. You can't make up policy on the fly, and it's no good going and listening to someone who's, you know, 5,000 miles away, who's never been here, and expect them to know better than your local professional staff. I mean, it's the other thing, right? He says, we want a professional board. You've got lots of professional people working
the
for you.
The professional politicians.
Yeah. Well, the people that Translink hires you know, in a competitive marketplace to come to the nicest place in the world to live.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people want to come and work in Vancouver.
Sure.
I was delighted to get a job there. And the people that I worked with were charming people, all of them well-educated, all of them very experienced. And they have produced some quite good systems.
They got skills. They got skills. Listen, Stephen, we're actually getting to the end of our show, and it's been
really?
Such a pleasure. Yeah, I know. We talked
for like this for hours.
I know.
Well, gosh, look at the time.
You're welcome back anytime. It's been fabulous having you on the show. Again, folks out there, you can go and read more about what Stephen Rees has to say, which is fabulous material, at Stephen Rees, that's P with a P-H and R-E-E-S, dot word.
WordPress.com.
Thank you very much. And
the man who said no, he didn't say no to Betty Swan. If Betty Swan had asked me to marry her, I'd have said yes. Shot.
Wouldn't we all? Well, listen, thanks again. We're going to go out listening to a song called Call Off the Invasion. Thank you very much, Stephen.
Get ready for me.